Okay, so I bought something new.
What did you buy, Matt?
I bought the 10.5-inch iPad Pro. I bought the 256-gig one Wi-Fi-only model. It's the one I picked up. Picked it up on the way out to vacation. We stopped in Houston, an Apple store at a mall in the Woodlands, and took it with us.
So, what's your first impressions of it? You've had it about a week now?
Yes. The screen is the best screen I have ever seen on a tablet / mobile device. I hope with everything that I am that they bring this screen to the iPhone for the next phone.
Well, the rumor has it that the next iPhone will actually be an OLED screen, so it should have all those vibrant colors at least.
Yeah, I mean, it does. It looks good. The True Tone display is really cool, where it kind of adjusts the white balance or whatever depending on the room that you're in. So sometimes it'll like look a little bit brighter white, and sometimes it looks a little bit duller white, but it just sort of helps your eyes see things a little bit better. I really like that. Like I said, the screen, the refresh rate, everything is like buttery smooth on the scrolling. It's just, it's a great device. The screen size, I like the 10.5, even moving from a 9.7-inch iPad Air 2. The screen is bigger, but it's not that much bigger, so, I mean, it's still nice having a little bit extra real estate. The device itself isn't much bigger than the iPad Air 2.
Oh, that was going to be my next question. I was curious if the device was actually physically larger or if they just chiseled down the bezels.
They actually just chiseled down the bezels some because it obviously wasn't going to fit, but, I mean, if you could just stretch the case a little bit, it would have fit the new one. I mean, it's not that much bigger. I mean, it's not like moving to the 12.9-inch iPad Pro. If you're used to the 9.7, you'll be used to the 10.5 pretty quick.
Well, very cool. So, what version of iOS are you running on it?
I have not put the beta on here. I've been tempted to because I really want to try the new multitasking stuff that supposedly this thing has been optimized for because it's got some incredible hardware in it. But I can't bring myself to run a beta OS. But I did install the High Sierra beta on my old MacBook Pro at home. And
how's that been running on the older hardware?
The only thing older still in that thing, really, is probably just the processor, and it's got a Core i5 in it because I've pretty much upgraded everything else that can be upgraded in it, from the wireless card down to the SSD hard drive that I put in it.
Yeah.
So, and then I actually took, the one I bought came with like a 5400 RPM laptop drive in it, 500 gig. I actually pulled that out when I put the SSD in. I bought a hard drive caddy for where the CD-ROM is. Pulled that out and had a 7200 RPM 500 gig drive that was a laptop size drive that I put into the hard drive caddy where the CD drive is. So it actually has two hard drives in it. So,
oh, very cool.
There's not too much old hardware in it except the processor.
Yeah, I have an old Mac in our house, but I don't think the Core 2 Duo is going to be supported on High Sierra.
I don't know when I think the cutoff is like 2009, I think, is when they cut it off. For the cutoff.
Oh, okay. This one's from 2010, so I might have to put it on there just to see how.
It may run it, but it may not run it well.
Well, it may boot. We'll say that.
It's like putting iOS 7 or 8 on the iPhone 4. It runs it, but it may not run it well.
Yeah. I didn't mention it. My wife said something the other day about how she misses her Mac. I was like, oh. Because, you know, when I built my Ryzen build, I gave her my HP Spectre X360, and she's been running that instead of her MacBook Pro since then. So she's a few months now.
I like my Mac. And don't get me wrong, everything that I do on my Mac, I can do on Windows. It's not a problem. I'm not doing anything too fancy. I guess the most extensive thing that I do as far as non-work stuff is editing this podcast in Logic or whatever. But, I mean, there's tons of applications for Windows that are as good or just as good, Adobe Audition, stuff like that, which you actually get to play with because you signed up for the Creative Cloud for the educator discount. So,
yeah, and I've actually, the only thing I really have installed from the Creator Cloud right now is Illustrator, Photoshop, of course, and After Effects, because some projects I was working on, I needed Illustrator and After Effects to use. But as far as recording, I have to disclose the crazy recording setup that I'm using today. It is a Samsung Galaxy S8 with a USB-C hub plugged into my Audio-Technica USB mic running SoundCamp. So I'm going to go ahead and apologize if in the middle of our session you hear like my phone exploding.
Or catching fire.
Yeah. You know, Samsung does have a history with that.
You know, speaking of that phone, they're actually bringing it back, I think, in Korea, South Korea, I guess, because that's where they're from.
Yeah, the fan edition.
The fan edition.
For the fan to cool it off.
Yeah, somebody on Twitter was saying, like, phone spelt with an F, and then exploding or something like that, phone exploding or something.
And, you know, sadly, I mean, all the manufacturers have had this battery issue. It's public now. I mean, the Note 7 was a fantastic piece of hardware with a really crummy battery. So if they got new batteries, it's probably going to be great.
Yeah, and these are refurbished phones, but they're not the ones that exploded. They're actually ones that got recalled. They changed the batteries in them, tested them or whatever, and sent them back out.
Yeah, I guess you wouldn't want to have to wipe the charcoal off your phone when you get it out of the box.
That's true. I wonder if they're going to be allowed to take them on planes.
Well, it's not the Note 7. It's the fan edition. So I guess it has to get a new FCC ID.
But I think it's only going to get released in Korea or whatever, and it's probably because they're all stuck in a warehouse and some manager's like, hey, maybe we need to try to get rid of these and make a little bit of money back.
Well, yeah. I mean, Samsung is in South Korea, so...
But back to the High Sierra Beta. There's a couple things I wanted to mention. The first thing, which I think is like the big selling point for High Sierra, is this new APS file system, the Apple file system, APFS. I was a little bit concerned as far as like how, because with the phone we talked about a few weeks back how the phone actually converted on the fly whenever you did an upgrade to iOS 10.3, and we found out like even before 10.3 they actually did it and rolled it back as testing or whatever. But with the High Sierra beta, they actually give you a checkbox during the install that says, hey, do you want to convert to APFS?
You know, and I guess that makes a lot of sense, because if you are running some legacy applications that might freak out from the new file system, you couldn't exactly upgrade to it.
I've actually installed the beta twice, and I've actually experienced both installs. So it does still run on HFS Plus, the old style. It still runs on that. But for my old MacBook Pro, since it's not really all it's really used at the house for, is just holding my music, having a complete edition of my music library, really essentially is what it's for, and sharing some video files to watch on the Apple TV. I was like, okay, just go ahead and convert it. And so I clicked the checkbox to convert to APFS. It did a firmware update to the actual Mac itself. Kind of scared me because it made a real loud beep that I had never heard before. Gave me a loading bar. I was actually telling you about this, and you're like, oh, that's probably just firmware. And you sent me a screenshot of a firmware example. I was like, oh, yeah, that's what it looked like. I mean, the loading bar was like almost three times thicker than what it usually is. And so I was a little bit scared. I was like, did this thing just die? But no, it came back. It installed after the loud beep. And I'm actually curious when I upgrade this, my newer MacBook Pro, if it's actually going to do the same thing. So I'm kind of curious about that.
You know, they might be having to put certificates and whatnot into the EFI firmware for the encryption. That's what I'm thinking is happening.
It is still encrypted. I mean, I do run the File Vault encryption, so, I mean, it did do that. And so it did the conversion, and it booted. Everything was working just fine. But the one thing I was worried about, and this is kind of what impresses to me, and I'll kind of give you some initial thoughts of APFS from what I've got to play with it. I was like, I think I mentioned this too on Hangouts too. I was like, I wonder if they're going to give me the ability to live migrate my other drives, like the other hard drive that's in my MacBook Pro. And sure enough, you can right click, convert to APFS right there in the menu.
Well, that's cool.
And so I was like, let's do it. I mean, it's not really doing anything either way, because that's actually where the music is actually housed. So, I mean, if I'm willing to take this chance with the whole computer, sure, because of the music or whatever, just do it to that drive, too. And so I right-clicked. A couple minutes later, it was converted to APFS. Still file-vaulted, encrypted, everything. Well, not file-vaulted on that one, but encrypted on that one. But, I mean, and so it just works great. But the one thing that I did notice, it appears that Time Machine, as of right now in the public beta, cannot back up an APFS drive. So Time Machine is broken. I didn't read the message box really clearly, so I was thinking, okay, maybe you can't back up APFS to an HFS Plus drive. And so I wiped out the Time Machine drive, because it's just a backup anyway, who cares, converted it to APFS, and then tried to set up Time Machine on that. I can set up Time Machine on that drive, but the message, if I actually would have read it closely, it actually says that it kind of excludes APFS drives from being able to back up to Time Machine.
Well, I guess they're doing block level backups through Time Machine, and once you encrypt the file system, you can't really identify the blocks, which ones it needs to dedupe for Time Machine to work.
Well, it was working fine with it being file vaulted before on HFS Plus. I'm thinking it might have something to do with the new snapshotting abilities and stuff like that that APFS gives, that actually Time Machine actually kind of needs to be reworked a little bit to be able to work with that better.
Well, that would make a lot of sense. I mean, they could gain some real efficiencies in Time Machine by using the snapshots.
Oh, Time Machine is going to get some major upgrades whenever it starts using APFS, from what I understand. Because, like, just with, like, the, like you're saying, doing the block level stuff and everything, it's just being able to do the snapshotting and being able to restore data quicker and stuff like that, it's just going to be a lot better. Time Machine's going to get a lot more efficient. But speaking of, like, duplicating files or whatever, they showed that test online on the keynote, not online, on the keynote, rather, where he took a video file and hit duplicate, and then, like, it was instantly duplicated as a copy.
Yeah.
That legit happens.
And that's cool. I think that's just part of the B-tree type file system. What it's doing is it's setting a reference point and then saving the deltas, the changes after that.
To me, it's kind of like they're making everything on the file system act like the Photos library.
Yeah.
Because the way the Photos library worked, and we saw this when we converted from iPhoto to the Photos app, was like it converted your Photos library to a new library file. And it, so say you had like a 30 gig iPhoto library, and it did this conversion thing to the Photos app. It says you had like a 30 gig Photos library. Well, the photo libraries weren't actually taking up 60 gigs. It was basically like linking to the actual data. And so that's kind of what they're doing with the entire operating system or the whole file system. So basically, it didn't actually physically duplicate the data. It just made like a symlink essentially to that existing data, and it won't actually write a new file until I was actually make changes to that new movie file.
And that's cool. I mean, I do like non-destructive edits,
and just the fact that they can do it without wiping the drive is mind-blowing.
Yeah, it's impressive. The file system conversions have always been really impressive, and especially when you're moving to one from, I hate to say it, as old as HFS Plus is, to such a modern file system such as APFS, it's really impressive.
And the neat thing about the whole conversion process, when you get to manually do a drive, like I did when I right-clicked convert to, they actually give you kind of a peek under the hood of like what command they're actually running. They actually show the command that you actually have to, like, if you wanted to do it in terminal, they actually show you the command with all the switches and stuff to actually convert the drive.
So is it just going through, since you saw the commands, is it just using Disk Utility, or is it a separate tool?
I think it's still using Disk Utility. I don't really, or it might be using like a specific APFS utility or something like that. I'll have to double check that.
Hey, you'll have to unconvert it and reconvert it and take screenshots.
I don't know if I can unconvert it.
Oh, come on.
I think I have a drive though that I can wipe, the Time Machine drive. Obviously, I can wipe it again. Put the HFS Plus volume back on it, and then convert it to APFS again, and I can kind of see what it actually is doing. But it's just kind of neat. It just blows my mind, because anytime I've ever done anything in Windows, like if I wanted to convert a USB disk or whatever, it's like you had to format the whole thing and just lose everything. And so just the fact that I didn't know it was possible, let's just put it that way. I didn't know you could take a drive and convert the file system and not lose any data.
Yeah, when NTFS first came out, there was conversion utilities, and they're still in there from FAT32 to NTFS. And then, of course, in the Linuxes, you can convert from the extended file systems to a newer extended file system, like extended 2 to extended 3 to extended 4 and whatnot. But there was never something as major as HFS to APFS.
I mean, it's pretty intense. And the fact that Apple had the guts to actually do it to people's phones as testing,
they
and roll it back.
The courage.
The courage, exactly. I mean, we say courage jokingly because of them taking the headphone jack away and calling it courage, which is still ridiculous. But
that actually was courage.
But that was courage. You're right. That exactly was courage to be able to pull that off. Because, I mean, that could have went entirely wrong.
Oh, yeah. And they would have had a lot of bad people.
Yeah. People would have been furious about that because, I mean, everything is on my phone. I mean, everything. Pictures of my kid. I mean, I have a DSLR that I take pictures of, but I take the pictures of that off the card and stick them in the Photos library. And
you know, and sadly, we have a DSLR at our house, too, but it's never with us. All our pictures are taken with our phones.
Yeah, and so, I mean, so when I do take, but when I do take DSLR pictures, they get dumped into my Photos library, which then with iCloud Photo Library, and I think in your case, Amazon Photos, they get uploaded to the phone or whatever. So, I mean, at least they're on the cloud. What if I would have been out and about and took some pictures that didn't get synced because they don't sync yet. They will give you that option in iOS 11, which I think is great for those of us that have some unlimited data or at least enough data to be able to do that. But what happens if people would have lost all those photos that hadn't got a chance to sync yet?
Those are the one things I'm always terrified of losing is my family photos.
But you know, I got so many pictures of my kid, I could lose one or two and be okay.
You know what he looks like.
But I don't want to lose them all because, I mean, we're apparently bad parents because we didn't really keep up with the baby book like we should have.
Well, you know what? I know this is such a rabbit hole, but I have two kids. The first child, at the end of the year, we went through Shutterfly and created this nice hardbound book with pictures to remember her first year and then her second year. And then our second child was born, and I don't even think we have any pictures of him hanging up in our house.
I mean, you just take them on your phone and you leave them there because that's where you're going to look at them, or you're going to show people, or you're going to share them is from your phone. And so, like, we didn't really write down milestones or whatever because we took videos or pictures of all that stuff, so we have it all in the photo library, and that's kind of how we go back and look at those things. Now, when he gets older and we want to pass down something, I think at some point we're going to have to go in and actually fill out a baby book or do something so we can actually get those memories on paper. But we do everything on our phone, and for them to take a chance
on
that, that's courage. But that is an incredibly long rabbit hole to go down. Just to mention that I bought an iPad Pro and I'm running the beta. But the other way that I installed the beta, I knew it was possible, but I never done it. But I have an external SSD drive. Well, it's SSD drive inside of a USB 3 enclosure. And I plugged it into this Mac because I just really wanted to see if I'd do it. I downloaded the installer, picked that drive as the install base. It didn't give me the option to convert that to APFS. It probably has something to do with being able to actually boot and encrypt and all that other fun stuff, and probably I think you mentioned the TPM security stuff for the secure boot stuff. But I installed the High Sierra beta on an external drive and was actually able to boot from that. I knew it was possible to do, but I never actually really done it.
I'm kind of curious how the performance was running on that.
Well, I mean, I'd really just opened a few things, didn't really do too much. I mean, I think the hard drive enclosure that I bought, it's like when USB 3 first came out, so it's not like the 5 gigabits per second one. It's like the 3 gigabits per second one.
Is the 3.0, which is still the same speed as SATA.
Yeah, it's still pretty quick. And so, I mean, but it booted pretty quick. I mean, it booted like there was like a regular SSD in it. So, I mean, it was a little bit longer instead of the internal one because, you know, the Apple, they do the, they got that fancy NVMe. Yeah, NVMe flash drives in them or whatever. So, I mean, it's not as quick as that, but it was still pretty quick. It was quicker than booting from, like, a spinny drive, so.
Oh, yeah. Well, that's cool.
But I wanted to be able to play with it more than just the house because I don't take that other MacBook Pro anywhere with me, so I can at least throw this drive in my bag. And if I'm out and about or up here at work or whatever during lunch, got some free time, I can kind of play with it, try some things out just because I'm curious. The thing is, though, they didn't add really – the one thing I really wanted to do was to try the APFS features because this is sort of a Snow Leopard release where there's not really a whole lot of new features. It's just kind of like major – it's like improvements to existing stuff, and so – there's not really a whole lot to try out, but I really just wanted to see the APFS stuff in place. And actually, since I can't actually see that on the external drive version, I may not even play with it that much. But right-click, duplicate that file, and it'd be instantly done. I mean, I even compared it to my Mac running just Sierra, and it's like you see the little loading bar as it copies or whatever. But it's just like right-click, done. Hardware that's 6 years older than what I'm running now, and it just... it's instantly done. It's crazy.
Very cool.
Mind blowing. So, I mean, I'm anxious to actually install it on newer hardware and actually take use of some of that. I spoke with someone on Twitter who actually installed it on basically the same version of Mac that I have, except he has like an i7 processor in it, and mine only has an i5. I asked him basically how the performance was, and he says it's about the same as HFS Plus. I mean, I guess, like, just using normal use or whatever, you're not really going to see a big significant advantage to switch into APFS. It's probably going to be about the same as far as performance-wise. But you should see, like, an increase in available disk space, stuff like that. It kind of better optimizes things like that. So I'm actually looking forward to switching to APFS. I haven't been on the Apple bandwagon fanboy train for as long as some people have since the original Mac or whatever, when HFS Plus or whatever came out. But just as long as I've done it, I've heard some horror stories about data getting corrupted or just disappearing and you not really knowing, because HFS Plus really doesn't have any security stuff like that built in for data verification and stuff like that. So you would just lose stuff and not really know it. So it almost gets me a little paranoid the older my device gets. Am I actually losing data and not knowing about it? All right, but I do have a little bit of follow-up from last week, I believe, when we talked about, well, not last week. We took a bit of a break last week because I was going on vacation.
I was too, ironically.
It just sort of happened, so we just took a little break. But a little bit of follow-up from the week before, I guess, when we talked about Windows upgrade cycles. It looks like Microsoft is going to start giving you a pop-up message that says you need to upgrade your Windows 10 device if you were still running the original build of Windows 10, which is great until it starts to get annoying, like the actual upgrade, let's go ahead and install Windows 10 if you were still running Windows 7 or Vista or 8 or 8.1. Those messages you were getting, you didn't want to install Windows 10, but it kept prompting you or whatever. It looks like you're going to get some upgrade messages to upgrade your stuff to make sure you're secure, because apparently they're keeping up with their promise that in 6 months or so, they're not going to support those builds of Windows anymore. Well, this one's like 18 months old at this point.
Yeah, and I commend Microsoft on sticking to the upgrade. Not so much the annoyingness of the upgrade messages, but people do need to be reminded that, hey, you need to upgrade. I mean, because there are huge security vulnerabilities that are actually being used in the wild that these things fix.
And it looks like you're going to be able to postpone this process for like 5 times before you're then prompted to confirm your privacy settings. So it looks like they may let you tell it to stop prompting you. So that may be a pretty good thing. And you might not have to do a registry hack like I had to do to get the Windows 10 prompt message to actually go away. But this sort of brings up a concern that I had. As we've talked about, I've went ahead and started with the Creators Update. And it makes me wonder if I should have just installed the long-term service channel or branch or whatever they're on for Windows 10. I know they renamed it for server or whatever. I don't know what it's still called for Windows 10.
I still think the consumer side is still called the long-term service branch.
It makes me wonder if I should have went with that as opposed to just the Creators Update build, so that I know that it's going to give myself, what it said, like 2 years of updates or something like that.
Yeah. And well, you'll continue to get those upgrades, those patches and whatnot, even not being on that, because it is... Well, it's still part of the One Core, which they do upgrade. If you were on the long-term service branch, you wouldn't get the new features you might want to play with.
I think that's kind of why I'm glad I made the decision I made, because I could see some of the things that we've talked about, like the new Paint and the new Movie Maker, actually being beneficial in our classrooms or whatever. And so I'm kind of glad that I went ahead and did the Creators Update so that we can have access to those things whenever they become available. I know the Paint 3D or whatever is, but I don't know if the Movie Maker is yet.
Yeah, it's not there yet, but I'm anxiously awaiting it.
But I guess also, since I run my WSUS server, I'm going to continue to get those updates or whatever, and I'll be able to push those out. But for schools or whatever that, for whatever reason, they're not updating their systems or whatever, this may potentially become an issue if they choose to install a version of Windows 10 that's not the long-term service, that they're going to have to either manually stay up on top of their updates or switch to the long-term service if they can continue to get updates.
Well, I mean, we also got to remember that by default, the peer-to-peer updating is enabled.
Well, I think on the education version that I installed, it's not enabled.
Okay. See, I'm running the professional on here.
Yeah, you buy your licenses with the computers. I have the school agreement. So I went ahead and installed the education edition.
Yeah, so I mean, it could be very different for different customers.
So I guess we'll see what happens. I mean, I upgrade things enough, I guess, that I don't think I'm going to have to too much. I mean, I replace hardware enough that I don't think this is going to be a problem for me. I'll probably re-image the machines that I've put Windows 10 on so far within the next 18 months. So I'm not entirely sure. And plus, like I said, I've got Windows Update Server running, so I mean, it'll be okay. I think I'll be fine.
Yeah, I wouldn't worry too much because you're on top of your SUS server.
But I mean, just if I was a bigger school district or whatever, I'm wondering if maybe the long-term servicing branch might be the better way to go because of this if you don't have the ability to stay on top of your updates like we're fortunate enough to be able to.
Well, I think anyone who wants a stable OS, you know, where they know the feature sets are going to be consistent, the long-term service branch would be the wise decision, especially like if you move to those districts like, let's say, HISD out in Houston where they have 800,000 machines or something absurd like that. You don't want that varying across the board. You want it all to be the same so you know what you're dealing with.
Yeah, and you want to make sure that everybody stays up to date, and if you can't stay up on top of these build updates or whatever, it may be best to do that one version that's going to stay the same for 18 months to 2 years or whatever.
Yeah, definitely.
So, but that's something to consider if you're looking to do a Windows 10 rollout. If you're able to stay up on top of your updates, we recommend going with the latest build or whatever so that you can use the newest feature. But if you're on your own, well, I mean, we're sort of on our own too. You have a bit of a help and I have a little bit of help too. But as far as like managing Windows and stuff, I'm sort of on my own with that. And you got a little bit more machines than a normal, like a smaller district like we do have. I think we have like 750 total machines, I think is what I'm managing. Look at the long-term servicing branch and make sure that and see if that maybe... See if the benefit of staying up to date without having to upgrade is more of a benefit to you than running all the new features. I mean, you just have to look at your needs. That's what it all boils down to, is looking at your needs.
And either way that you go, you are running the same one core that is going to get the same security updates. So you're not losing any security by moving to a long-term servicing branch. That would be absurd of them.
But speaking of security... back in the news is a new ransomware, and this actually happened a couple weeks ago while we were actually going on vacation or whatever. But there's a new Petya, not Petya, ransomware out there.
Yeah, this one had some. Sorry, I don't mean to jump in, but this one had something really interesting to it. It looked and behaved kind of like the WannaCrypt, WannaCry one, but it was not intended to actually make money. People to give money. To decrypt their files. It was meant to destroy the systems.
Oh, so this one's more of a... This is destructive, not...
Yeah, and it was very targeted towards companies and hospitals and those kind of things. I don't even think this one hit a consumer space.
I know. I read somewhere that FedEx, I think somewhere, got hit with it pretty bad.
Yeah, and it wasn't like you could pay and get the stuff back. No, its intent was to destroy.
It says this one Twitter account, Hacking Dave or whatever, says spread super fast, saw organization 500,000 systems hit in under 10 minutes.
Oh my, that hurts. I mean, that's straight up warfare.
Reading from this Verge article, it says where WannaCry focused on poorly patched systems, Petya seems to have hit hardest among large corporation networks, like you mentioned, a pattern that's partially explained by how the virus spread. So it's like it's just going through that network. It says once a single computer on a network was infected, Petya leveraged Windows networking tools like Windows Management Instrumentation, we're actually going to talk about a little bit later, and PSExec to infect other computers on the same network.
And that is the very reason that you need to make sure the account you're logging in with is not a domain admin, because PSExec is going to run at whatever privilege you have remotely.
Yeah, and that's kind of where I fall short sometimes. My account, I'm kind of lazy in that fact where I don't want to log into another account.
Oh, we all are. I mean, it's a hassle, especially when you have 15 windows open doing 100 different tasks, and you don't want to have to switch accounts to do something real quick like manage a user.
But the one good thing about this Petya thing as opposed to this WannaCry, it looks like there's some police in the Ukraine that have actually raided a company that is allegedly distributing the malware, and so it looks like we actually might be able to have shut down the people actually responsible for it. So that's at least some good news, I guess, in a way. So maybe they can actually catch the guys that are actually doing it. Now, you're probably not going to get any data back or whatever because, like you said, they're not doing this to make money. They're just being it to be jerks. So I guess we'll see what happens. But this is only until the next one pops up. But even though there's always going to be another ransomware attack, it looks like Microsoft, starting with the Fall Creators Update, they're actually going to start doing a little bit more, proactive protection for your machines. It looks like they're going to start using AI to kind of determine if something is a malware or not, or some kind of ransomware, before it actually can kind of do too much damage. And actually, they're going to start using a new feature called controlled folders, which is actually in the Windows 10 preview now.
Oh, yeah. And I think AI is a perfect situation, a perfect usage scenario for this, because it can spot pretty quickly whether a person is doing this or not. Because how fast can you type in to encrypt folders, Matt?
Usually I have to find how to do it because I forget.
I know. So, I mean, if it's something starts just running through a user profile, it'll be able to detect whether that was you or not pretty quickly.
Yeah, and I'm kind of liking this idea of controlled folders too, which in a way, that's kind of what we were doing with group policy or whatever, not allowing some things to run from certain folders or whatever, but it looks like this is actually going to start protecting more than just even what we're doing.
Oh, I know. And controlled folders, I'm actually really excited about this because we do have our policies in place that we do now, but this could take care of those places we can't lock down.
So it's really, really great idea, and it's really great that Microsoft has... I don't know why it's kind of taken them this long. I guess maybe the technology hasn't been there to be able to do these sort of things, but it's glad that it's happening. And I know that I know ransomware and malware isn't real. I guess it's there on Mac, but it's not as much there. It's not as popular.
Now, I foresee with APFS people trying to take advantage of that encrypted system in there to do some malicious intent, because then they'll have an expectation of, well, this is available to everyone.
Yeah, and I can kind of see that too. And so kind of what I'm getting is I hope that Apple can kind of like follow Microsoft's footsteps in being able to use some kind of detection stuff built into the OS, either with AI or some kind of Windows Defender like software on the Mac itself.
Yeah, we can give, and then they can make the icon like Siri with a little police badge on it.
Yeah, that'd be kind of cool. but yeah, so it's great that they're trying to do this, because, and I think I even read somewhere that I think there's actually some ransomware out there for Linux now too. So
yeah, I mean, it's everywhere. And well, I mean, with Linux, I mean, a lot of our network systems use it, not just our servers, but the actual network hardware, like the switches and routers and whatnot, they run Linux a lot of the time as their underlying OS.
And you actually put in a document, put in a link down at the bottom of the document later about WMI actually coming to Linux, and considering that this Petya and NotPetya actually spread through WMI and PSExec, do you see them adding WMI for Linux? Before you kind of get into like what that means for Linux, do you see that kind of being a problem to like this causing more of a problem in Linux like it has been in Windows?
I don't know if it would be... I don't think the problems would exist in the same space because, well, I mean, of course, all these things are still executing binaries, and even though the management tools would be in there, those binaries wouldn't be compatible with Linux to execute.
So what does WMI on the Linux mean for Linux? What is that going to give us the ability to do?
Well, I think it's part of a... This is not a Microsoft project. This is someone else. I can't pull up the article right now to look at. Wonderful Samsung won't let me do multitasking on this recording app. But WMI is the Windows Management Instruments. It's what lets you do remote management on a server without actually logging into it. It's exactly how Server Manager does all its work and all your remote consoles. They're using WMI. And they're wanting to add this into Linux as a feature so you can use Windows tools to manage Linux servers for those real heterogeneous environments. That way you could have one console manage both. And it's just kind of trying to present this really hardened and tested remote management tool into Linux. Because right now, remote management in Linux is either A, using Puppet or Chef, or B, doing remote SSH running commands on it. There's not really... Yeah, I mean, they all have their things, and of course, Landscape's limited just to Ubuntu, and it's still doing basically a Puppet or Chef or a remote shell, and this is just a non-interactive way to do the control. I'm kind of excited about it. I hope it works. Now, don't expect to open users and computers and connect to a Linux machine to add users and computers. That's not the goal of it. But it's just trying to present that same standard onto Linux.
From the article that you linked, it looks like Darren Hart, it says he worked at Intel, but he now works at VMware. and so we all know how much I love VMware. But considering that he's from VMware and he's kind of ported this over as an official bus or whatever, or a proper bus, it looks like that it may be designed maybe like in VM management to like be able to manage, I guess, maybe your ESX hosts or maybe your Linux VMs a little bit better from maybe the vCenter console or something like that.
Yeah, that'd be really cool. I mean, since Microsoft has all the Hyper-V stuff already embedded into the Linux kernel, they could take those hooks and attach all sorts of other functions to it, make our management easier.
That's one thing I do love about dealing with Ubuntu and farm my virtual machines or whatever. I install a Windows VM and I have to install the VMware tools or whatever. It looks like whether you're installing a Linux VM or a Linux physical hard drive server or whatever, the VM tools are already there.
Yeah, they have Open VM tools should be in the repositories by default, but Microsoft's Hyper-V VM tools are actually integrated into the Linux kernel directly.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. It's crazy. Who would have thought that?
That may be what it's for, is to maybe manage your Linux VMs kind of like you do your Microsoft VMs or whatever, and give you that a little bit more easily ability. But I know I tried Landscape before, and I don't know, maybe it's just because I didn't give my Linux VMs a whole lot of resources. It seemed like Landscape was very resource intensive, and so I actually got rid of it because I didn't really see I'm only managing like 4 or 5 Linux VMs, so it wasn't that much work to just go into SSH into each of them and run the commands that I need to run to upgrade. But from what I did mess with it, though, if you had like a pretty large environment of Linux machines, it is pretty neat the things that it can do. But like you said, it's just running those open source VM, those open source Linux management tools like you mentioned, and running SSH commands on it directly.
Oh, yeah.
On those hosts. So, I mean, it's not really doing that much. So, I would like to see, like, some better control of the Linux or whatever.
Yeah, it'd be kind of neat to be able to write a PowerShell script to work on your Linux servers remotely.
Yeah, because, I mean, anything to make a Linux management a little bit easier, I guess.
Oh, yeah.
With maybe tools that you already have existing, like connecting it into the server manager itself, like you manage your server 2016 machines or whatever.
Yeah, honestly think this guy in VMware should hit up Microsoft on this, because we see how Linux-friendly Microsoft is now. I mean, heck, they give you a version of it with Windows 10 now. They would probably willingly help this guy out a lot.
I know you've been running that for a while, but I actually installed it a little bit before I went on vacation, and like you said, it is a full version of Linux Ubuntu server running basically with Windows. I mean,
yeah, not even virtualized, it's just there,
same commands connecting to the same Canonical repositories or whatever to install software and stuff. I mean, it was like legit there. I mean, everything that I'm doing in my Linux servers I can do on that Windows machine.
Yeah, they wanted to be the single development platform, and I think they're almost there.
I mean, I think that's actually even going to boost their Azure cloud storage, cloud hosting stuff, because it's like you can run your Windows virtual machines or whatever you need to run Windows hosted, but you can also run your Linux stuff hosted on the same machine and not have to pay for double the resources when you may not need to. So, I mean, that's great. I love it.
Yeah, and I'm sure even with the containerization of the world, it'll get even better.
But a little bit more education news. It looks like Google Earth is adding in some more education stuff.
Yeah, this is pretty cool. I mean, Google Earth has been a product that a lot of classrooms have been using for years just to show geography and just show different places in the world. And it looks like Google's giving away a curriculum with it, some lesson plans and whatnot, to where you can fully utilize the tool better, which is great because teachers aren't going to have to reinvent the wheel to use Google Earth. I mean, I think it's interesting. I mean, anything that they give the teacher to better do their job easier, that's wonderful. And a lot of them want Google Earth on their machines, and now, well, they have a legitimate reason.
Well, and I know too, I've seen some teachers and stuff use it as like virtual field trips too. Because, you know, being in rural Southeast Texas or whatever, I mean, without making probable multiple day trips, it's hard to take field trips to see things that are other than Houston, you know? Houston, San Antonio, stuff that you can't make in a day and then come back in the same day. And so using Google Earth or whatever to be able to see, like, to fly over to Paris or whatever and see all the historic buildings over there or to Italy and see the Colosseums and stuff like that, it actually opens up those kids that may not ever have a chance to see those kinds of things. And now that they're actually having curriculum based on those sort of things and can actually jump you to those destinations as you're teaching about them, I think it's great. I mean, Google does a lot of stuff with education, and I mean, it's obvious with G Suite. I mean, it's almost like G Suite was made for education first before it was made for business and some of the aspects of it. And so I think it's great, like you said, to be able to see that stuff, to see, like, this, they're calling it Voyager, and it's going to showcase, like, guided tours from scientists, nonprofits, and storytellers and other organizations or whatever. So, I mean, it's gonna be able to open up, like, virtual field trips and stuff like that. And I know that we've used a organization in the past to try to do some stuff with distance learning over some video calling or whatever, but I think your opinion of it has kind of been like mine, where I just wish there was a little bit more better content with it or whatever, and so maybe this is that better content that we were wanting.
Now, I know that they did mention virtual field trips and whatnot, and that would be part of the lesson plans and the curriculum that they're developing, so yeah. I mean, that's exactly what they wanted to do with that other product that we were talking about, and it just never really materialized. I mean, the technology wasn't good enough, it just wasn't dynamic enough where it could do anything besides show a room.
And I think, too, it's all about finding the right content providers. And when you're Google and you have billions of dollars, you can find those right content providers.
Oh, yeah. People are going to come to you going, hey, I want my content in this library.
I think it's, I mean, other than that, we've only really used, I don't know if you still use, well, it used to be called United Streaming, but now it's like Discovery Education, basically from the Discovery Channel. That's really essentially all we've had in the past as far as to be able to do anything like this in the classroom.
Yeah, I mean, we have it, but it's really not used for much of anything but the Magic School Bus.
Yeah, I mean, we see that too. And I mean, we have some people that are using it, and I know the counselor over the elementary uses it a lot whenever she does her presentations on like bullying and stuff like that. Discovery Education Streaming or whatever has a lot of good videos for that kind of stuff. But this is like, I see this being more for than just elementary kids or whatever. I think this is like from everybody on up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm sure that even if you move into high school and whatnot, they're going to have those same lessons and virtual field trips to like Google data centers and whatnot, so you can show off the STEM stuff there.
Yeah, and so I'm going to share this article. I think we have a new geography teacher this year. I don't know who it is, but I'm going to make sure that I get this link over to him and be like, hey, this may be something you want to integrate in your class this year. So,
oh, I'm sure they'll eat it up. And being that Google Earth Pro is free now, well, you get all the pro tools that were part of the Google Earth before for free.
Yeah, I mean, it's why not? I mean, even if you're just a home user and you just want to go check things out, even on yourself, I mean, it's a great thing to just do. Sometimes I find myself doing that. I just kind of get in the street view and it's like, hey, I wonder what this looks like and stuff like that.
Yeah, it's probably the only way I'm ever going to actually see the Eiffel Tower anyway.
Yeah, unless you go to like Paris, Texas.
Yeah, do they have one there?
I think they have one, yeah.
Oh, awesome. I'll have to do that.
Or Las Vegas before you lose all your money.
As long as I get to stop at the buffet, I'm happy.
But speaking of this kind of Google Maps thing, I know I didn't throw this in a document, but this just sort of popped in my head. With iOS 11, Apple came out with something called ARKit to basically help developers come up with augmented reality stuff or whatever. And I have seen some demos, I think, with their Maps app that they have really done some incredible things with their flyover feature that they have, where they kind of like make it 3D or whatever. And so it's almost making Apple Maps kind of like a Google Earth application. And so, I mean, and I can see like AR, because, you know, I'm real big on the AR thing over the VR stuff. I see AR being more of an advantage in education than VR per se. But, I mean, I could really see like Apple stepping up with ARKit or whatever and doing these kinds of things to kind of compete with Google Earth or whatever. But this doesn't require an iOS device or a Mac. So, I mean, it's...
Yeah, and I think that's Google's biggest advantage, is it doesn't require a particular hardware vendor.
So, but I mean, it's really neat that it seems like more than just Google are getting into this space, that it's actually becoming important.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people forget that Google Earth wasn't made by Google. They bought a company, I think it was called Keystone, and it was called Earth Explorer, and they just bought that company, so Google didn't even create it originally.
I mean, if you can't, if somebody does it better than you, acquire them.
Yeah, and honestly, I hope Apple makes an awesome product for it, because sadly, right now, it's the only one that really kind of does what it does. I mean, we have Bing Maps, but gosh, the imagery for it is so old, and it's from like old tax assessor plane imagery that, yeah, it's awful. We need some more up-to-date imagery.
And Apple Maps is getting better. I mean, Apple Maps was a disaster when it first came out. In fact, I think an executive vice president or a senior vice president or something actually lost their job over Maps or whatever.
Yeah, you don't have to. You don't tell people to turn their car into rivers.
I actually got told to get out and walk one time.
Hey, I'm sorry. There's construction in this area. The fastest route is walking.
Yeah, I mean, I was literally like 5 miles away from my destination and told me to pull over and walk. I don't know. I didn't know where I thought I was.
Is that part of their like health kit too?
Well, this was way before health kit, so I don't know. But I can say that they actually fixed that problem, because I went to that same location. Now, I don't know. Would it be 7 years later? Because when I went the first time, I went to Best Buy and bought the original iPad 1, the first generation iPad, and took it to this location and was going to set it up there. We were going camping for a few days. And so I went and bought the iPad and brought it to this location, and that's when it told me to get out and walk. So I guess 7 years now or whatever.
Man, it's been a long time. You know, I guess it has been that long, because the iPhone came out 10 years ago now.
Yep, because this will be the 10 year. I mean, that was a big thing on Twitter, apparently, an iPhone coming out 10 years ago, so.
Oh, I hope they make it look like the 10th anniversary Macintosh computer so bad.
But, I mean, it looks like some good things are coming for education as far as from Google and Apple. And so I didn't see too many improvements as far as like iCloud for education or whatever coming out of WWDC, but I'm hoping that with iOS 9.3, we had a pretty big education release with a bunch of new features. So maybe with 11.3 this coming year, maybe we can get some new education features.
Yeah, one of the Apple products that I would really love to see them improve on and open up to more people is iTunes University. I would love to have that kind of product within my Google infrastructure, because it does it best.
I would just like to be able to create iTunes U content on a Mac.
This is very true. They really need to show that platform some love.
I mean, iTunes U is great. I mean, now granted, I don't know. They've recently added like grading and assignments and quizzes and stuff like that to iTunes U. Before, it was like when it first came out, I just kind of saw it as a collection of PDF documents and podcasts that you could watch or listen to or whatever. And it seems like after Google Classroom came out and added those abilities, they're like, hey, maybe we should add this ability into iTunes U. And so it's kind of like iTunes U is kind of like Google Classroom in a way, but in a way it's more than Google Classroom.
Well, the biggest feature that I wanted from it that Google still doesn't really do, they have the ability to, they just don't, is offline by default.
Yeah, that they do that, where you could download everything.
Yeah, and I would love that, because there's a lot of users in our base that just don't have access at home. And if I say I was going to give them an assignment in the class I'm teaching, well, they have to be able to do it. And if they don't have connectivity, they can't.
You know, we actually run into that same issue too, where we have a teacher that decided to do a flipped classroom this past year or whatever. And so she would, like during her conference time or after school or whatever, she would record her lectures, upload them to Google Drive. The kids would watch the lectures for homework and actually do the actual homework work in the classroom where she was there. She could help them work with them one-on-one or work with them one-on-one. I don't know why an extra one was in there. But we're in the same boat up until recently, where we got the big neighborhood behind the school or whatever is finally getting some cable internet or whatever, which everybody is raving about. But that brings us to our last news story that we wanted to mention before we may or may not get to our topic today. But AT&T's rural broadband wireless is actually expanding, and I'm hoping that that will actually help like my area. I don't know if we're like listed in the areas that it's expanding to, but I hope it eventually gets here.
I don't know how it happened, but Buena, Texas is the third test site in the entire country for this.
Well, that's great. That's really going to help your students out. So how is this going to work? Is this going to work like 802.11ac or LTE, or like is it going to be 802.11n or AC or whatever running on top of LTE? How will the end user see it?
Well, and unfortunately, I'm friends with one of the installers on here, so I get a lot of insider information, of course, that we're going to talk about that I shouldn't know. But it's going to, from what he's telling me, it's going to be a combination of LTE for the further outliers, but then point-to-point wireless for those closer. So the tower is actually going to house both technologies, so they'll be able to use it as a cell phone tower, along with the long-reach LTE for the straggler customers, and then the point-to-point wireless technology based on the 802 standards. So we'll have, basically, if you're familiar with Ubiquiti equipment, they're going to be using a lot like the ISO beams and the power beams, that same standardization of equipment. So it'll be 802.11 signaling, but with proprietary timing on top of it. So they'll be doing like GPS syncing and whatnot to get the higher data rates through it.
I mean, I'm kind of confused too. I don't know if like maybe you're getting different information than what Engadget's getting or whatever, but it says Engadget saying that subscribers will shell out $60 per month for an LTE connection with 160 gigabyte of data. Like, what, I mean, if that's the case, what is the difference between AT&T just throwing up new towers everywhere and selling them a MiFi?
Well, anyway, I think that what I had posted with Engadget versus what we have is very different. I believe that push with that Engadget is talking about is with the original FCC broadband push that they had funding for versus with our area and some of the areas around Atlanta. That's where the other test sites are part of a new infrastructure technology that they're going to try.
Yeah, well, that's great. That's great.
So, yeah, they're going to have the DirecTV guys come out, basically install this white box on the roof and point it to a tower. And we'll see how well it works. From my experience using this technology, I think it's going to work great. It's a perfect use case scenario for this last mile connection that we have such issues with.
So for all intents and purposes, let's just call it, they're going to come plug in a modem and point it to a tower. Even though it's probably not really a modem. They're going to hand off what? An Ether, a Cat5 link to like... to you to plug into like any old regular router that you may or may not have or whatever, and basically that is what you see as your internet connection as opposed to my cable connection?
Correct. And I think they'll be issuing out, of course, wireless routers like they do with everything else, but it will just be a standard Ethernet handoff.
For $5 more a month.
Yeah. For a crummy router.
Yeah. You say that, my boss, who lives in the neighborhood back behind the school or whatever, that just got the cable connection from Spectrum, she opted in for the whole home wireless or whatever that is basically just a router inside the cable modem or whatever, and she has a pretty, her house is larger than my house, and that thing covers that whole house. So, I mean, they must have some pretty powerful antennas, so, I mean, maybe AT&T can get some of those antennas.
Yeah. Was it Scientific Atlanta?
It's either that or some kind of Cisco bot. Well, that's Scientific Atlanta is Cisco at this point, I think. But that's great. I really hope that some of your students out there will be able to jump onto that, because I know that, I mean, and I feel bad too, because we talk about how we provide Wi-Fi for the students or whatever, and we have to take it away or throttle it down or restrict it in this way or that, because of federal regulations and whatnot, or just because they do some things that they shouldn't do, so we take it away. But, I mean, up until recently, I mean, I have been probably the only internet access those kids are going to have.
Yeah,
unless they live in those neighborhoods. And I hope it works well for Buna, and I hope AT&T decides to roll it out nationwide, and I hope that this area gets covered too, because, I mean, I'm going to try to say this and not try to be politically incorrect or whatever, but in our community or whatever, it's very economically dispersed or whatever, and it seems that more of the, we'll just say, blessed neighborhood, more economically blessed in a way, is getting the internet connection first rather than some of the areas out here that are not so fortunate, I guess. And so, I mean, but I have a lot of kids that are living in some of those, and not, I have a lot of kids that are not living in such the blessed neighborhood. So, and I want them to have some benefit too.
Oh, definitely. And that's one of the huge benefits with doing it over a wireless connection is, well, there's no infrastructure they have to lay in the ground. They're just pointing an antenna that direction.
And in some instances, the towers are already here. Just utilize them.
Yeah. Well, I hope it works out. And like I said, I have a a friend of mine that works is actually part of this project, so I'm getting updates fairly regular on it. So I'll definitely be passing them on.
Since you have a hookup, what are the chances that you can maybe get a demo like at your school to be able to like try it out and see it or whatever in action, and maybe to help maybe promote it to get them some users or whatever?
Well, as soon as it comes on, they're going to bring one up to the school. He's already told me. So
sweet. So you'll actually get to use it and be a part of it. That's great.
Yeah, we'll see if it's, maybe it'll be something that we can viably use as a failover connection.
Exactly. I mean, because, you know, two is one, one is none, so.
Well, I guess that would be kind of difficult, because if my first one goes down, which is also AT&T, I'm going to be relying on an AT&T one that was probably riding on the same infrastructure that my first one was, so.
Riding on the same fiber cable that's coming into Muna.
Yeah, the same one got cut not too long ago.
That's crazy. And it brought, like, three districts down or whatever?
Oh, dude, it brought all the way from right there at LCM up to Jasper down.
Man, that's crazy. All because somebody on a pipeline truck was just digging a hole that you shouldn't have been digging.
Dig, dig, dig.
But I think that's it for today. I mean, we've gone over an hour or whatever. I don't know what it'll be once I edit it down or whatever, but I think we should just hang on to our topic. We're going to talk about subscription services next week. And the whole premise of that was an app that I like actually moved to a subscription model, and I got kind of upset about it. And I just kind of want to talk about it and talk about like the different things that we subscribe to as far as the school district, and whether there are benefits or disadvantages or whatever, and things that aren't subscriptions that maybe ought to be to actually help us do things better. Like I wish they offered a Mac subscription where I could just pay Apple $30 a month and I get a new Mac every time there's a new one that comes out. That would be nice to have.
You would love that.
I would love that. I would sign up for that day one. But so we'll talk about that next week. And so I guess that's it. If you have any questions or feedback regarding the news that we discussed today, you can reach out to us on Twitter. Chris is found at @feeks, and I am at @twistofmatt. Or you can reach out to the show at Educating Tech. Send us an email at educatingtech@gmail.com. Leave us a review on iTunes or however you want to do that. For more episodes, you can visit educatingtech.net, where you can also find links to subscribe or share to let other people know. But I guess that's it. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next week. See you later, Chris.
See you later, Matt.